You're listening to WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 993wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today you'll hear a conversation with Robin Rahm, who has edited a new book called Double Bind, Women on Ambition, and it's published by LiveWrite, which is a division of Norton. She is the author of The Mother Garden and The Mercy Papers. Her work has appeared in The New York Times, The Atlantic, O, The Oprah Magazine, and elsewhere. She teaches at Warren Wilson College and lives in Portland, Oregon. Here's a little bit of information about Double Bind. Even as toweringly successful women from Gloria Steinem to Beyoncé embrace the word feminism, the word ambition remains loaded with ambivalence. Women who are naturally driven and goal-oriented shy away from it. They're loath to see themselves or be seen by others as aggressive. Double Bind could not come at a more urgent time, a necessary collection that explodes this conflict, examining the concept of female ambition from every angle, in essays full of insight, wisdom, humor, and rage. I spoke to Robin Rahm a week ago, and I asked her to start by talking about how this book came to be. Where did she get the idea for Double Bind, Women on Ambition? I hope you enjoy the conversation.
I think that the book sort of came about, there's sort of two stories probably, or two ideas. One was that I was sort of privy to a really ugly ambition war at an artist colony between two women journalists.
Oh, wow.
That, were sort of accusing each other of stealing ideas and, trying to outwrite each other. And I felt myself both sort of repelled by the cutthroat nature of the quarrel and sort of attracted by one of the women's just really easy entitlement, and like it was very male. And she's quite successful. And I struggled with sort of parsing out what it was that I was feeling. Like watching this go on, I related to both characters. I found myself equal parts repelled and admiring of the winner of the quarrel, who, just proceeds with absolute ruthlessness towards what she wants. And I sort of noted in myself that I probably wouldn't have found that really all that remarkable if it had been two men. But because it was two women, it seemed more remarkable. So I started actually writing fiction about it, which never really got anywhere. I just noticed in myself a lot of competing feelings. And then in my own life, I had chased for like a decade an academic career. And I really loved teaching, but I kind of couldn't make all the pieces in my life match up with moving everywhere and the college I was at went out of business, and then I took a job in a place I really hated, and I found that my desire to live a certain kind of life and my writing and my desire to have a child directly competed with other ambitions, and that was also complicated. And so I just was thinking a lot about it, and then at one point I was talking to my agent about other things, and I had written an essay for somebody else's anthology, and I said that I enjoyed writing for people's anthologies, and she's like, why don't you just make an anthology? And I was like, I don't really have any ideas except for maybe ambition. And then I asked a couple of women if they wanted to do it, and they said yes. And then they said, well, I'm not ambitious. And that's all in the book, I think.
Yeah.
But that's how it started. And then once I had a few yeses, I felt like I was kind of in and I had to do it. So I did it.
Well, it's helpful to have also had your agent's support from the beginning, because that would help you find a publisher to put this out there into the world. But you mentioned your own story of trying to navigate career and family, and particularly your career. And I really enjoyed your essay, and I have questions about that. But I think first I just want to ask how you went about finding authors. I'm curious, did you ask either of the women who you had experienced the argument at the outset?
I asked one of them, early on, and I think early on she was probably in the proposal, if I remember correctly, but she didn't end up, she ended up doing another project, and she didn't end up writing an essay for it, so no. And I don't know that either of them really knew how preoccupied I got with that whole spat.
Yeah.
It was sort of a private preoccupation more than anything.
Yeah, it's interesting, though. I mean, that's just how these things start, and it might just live in your own mind until it becomes something else. So how did you find the other authors? Did one mention another, or, you know, was there some sort of organized effort?
Well, the book went through a couple of iterations. So the first go-around, I mostly had writers, you know, people that were in my orbit a little bit more. Some of those people are in the book, like Joan. Joan was one of the very first people.
Right, and I'll just mention Joan Lee Gant is an author who I've interviewed before, and she's in this book. She's a wonderful novelist. And yeah.
And I love her essay. And she actually wrote that essay on spec for the proposal, which is truly generous and wonderful, as did Pam Houston. So that means, you know, people liked the idea of the project, had an idea for an essay, wrote it with no idea if they'd ever get paid. And so those are some of the first essays, Claire Bay Watkins too. And then ultimately it became clear that the better book was going to have a much broader lens looking at women from across lots of professions. And so we started, I guess I started just really throwing out all kinds of feelers for women in science and women in business and women in theater. And I had a couple of contacts, you know, lots and lots of things didn't pan out. Yeah. Actually, interestingly, more essays probably didn't pan out than the ones that did. Like, you know, I'm sure I had 30 yeses and 30 partial essays that people couldn't finish or didn't have the time, or, you know, they just, you're asking women who are running businesses or, you know, tech conferences or whatever to also write a 10-page, you know, beautifully written, thoughtful, nuanced essay, and they just don't have time. It's like, right. It takes more than an hour flight to do something like that.
Well, the very nature of the assignment means that you're finding women who, well, I mean, for the most part, these are women who are very engaged in their professions, and they are pretty ambitious, so that probably means that it would be harder to find women to write for this essay collection than it would for women who were writing about, I don't know, something else. So
yeah, and you know, there were several problems like that. You know, it's one, it's time. Mm-hmm. Women are busy. The other thing is that if you're really, really, you know, the top surgeon in the hospital, that doesn't mean you can write, you know, so you can be really, really good at something, and often you've mastered one skill set at the expense of others. So all these wonderful novelists can write beautiful essays, but when you're looking for women in tech or in banking or, you know, in biology, you often, you know, you sometimes have women that can do all of these things, but it's harder to find the women who have the time and the skill. And then the third issue that was a challenge was that the topic is much, much, much trickier in reality than it seems when you first think about it. Like, almost everybody thought, oh yeah, ambition, I have that. I have some issues to talk about regarding ambition. And then it was like, wait, what is ambition?
Yeah. Wait. I loved Christina Henriquez has this great essay where she sort of tries to define ambition before she can even write about it. And then the whole essay ends up being her kind of quest toward a definition, which was great.
Yeah. First of all, the definition of ambition is tricky, but then also just how to talk about it. I think for women, it gets hard fast to talk about ambition because it's attached to ideas about identity and power and love and, you know, just it attaches to everything, child rearing. And it's the minute you try to tackle something, you suddenly feel like you sound awful, you know, you sound power hungry, or you sound egotistical, or you know, you don't want to say these things. And so this was just, you know, a kind of a constant source of strife with the writers, you know, just trying to sort out what you can say, what you can't say. And of course, as an editor, you know, I'm constantly trying to get people to say the things that were hard to say, because that's the point of the book.
Right. Did you have a certain assignment that you gave them at the beginning, or did you just say, write on ambition and preferably we'd like this number of words?
I did probably every possible thing. Some people needed a more structured assignment, and we would talk, we'd have a conversation and sort of land somewhere on a good essay topic. Some people, actually, I think I pretty much knew what people were at least attempting to do before they did it, so that I didn't want people to write the same essay over and over again. So we would, sometimes the essays that actually were written were significantly different than the pitch. But it worked out. We got a lot of, we covered a lot of ground. There's a few things we didn't cover. Like, I think it's interesting that we didn't really have an essay that covered ambition within a marriage. We don't have a lot of like relationship and the fallout of ambition in relationships, which I think for women is also a pretty significant topic.
Actually, I think your essay probably touched on that more than most, because, and you didn't specifically get personal about your relationship, but there's definitely a point at which it sounds like your relationship went through some transition as you're trying to work out what's happening next.
And I think, we have a lot of women thinking about their mothers. That was somewhat accidental. So it's interesting to see, the holes and the places where we're really reinforced, like our mothers, and then the places where we're still a little bit quiet, like our marriages and domestic relationships. And in fact, we had one woman, and I don't want to name names, but she had a little bit about her marriage in the book, and at the 11th hour took that whole section out. So,
Okay. Well, there are different takes, and I loved that. There are a number of personal stories that people tell about their own experiences and their own ambitions and how well or poorly they were able to realize their goals. And then as we said, Christina Henriquez's quest to define ambition. Then there's Francine Prose's essay, which was wonderful. And it starts out seeming less like a personal essay, more like a look at the whole subject. And then it kind of zooms back in. But I loved how she points out that ambitious women are interesting, in part because of the struggle of being a woman with ambition. And she also makes the point that naked ambition can be seen as unattractive in men or women, but really probably more so for women. Anyway, there's just lots of different takes on the way it all came together, which was fun. So what was your editorial process like? Did you work within a certain time period and everybody's writing at the same time and getting back to you with a certain deadline? Or were you trying to work with one author at a time? Or how did that go?
Oh, it sounds so dreamy to have everyone have one deadline and then the book is just materializes before you read through it. I wish I could say that that was the process. I think that in my fantasy life, that was the process, this book will take 18 months and I'll have the idea and I'll give all these people a deadline. But the truth of the matter is that almost everyone missed their deadline. We had people, anywhere from 4 months late to like a year late turning in an essay. We had people who did multiple rewrites. We had people who did multiple rewrites and couldn't quite get there. It took forever. I think I started this project in maybe 2012. That was when I had mostly writers involved, and then it grew from there. And then I was writing a proposal, and then the proposal circulated, and then it changed when I had, more help with division, with the editor, and we recruited people. And some people, like Sarah Rule, who's amazing, I contacted her and I said what the book was and did she want to write an essay? And she was like, gosh, I'd love to, but I pretty much am booked solid for like a year. I don't have time. Unless I did it today. I'm going to do it today. And she did. She did it like within 3 days. And that was amazing. But she was the outlier for sure. So really it was just this incredibly prolonged herding of cats. And some of the cats would just vanish too. You'd be like in the middle of it and they just vanish into their world again. And I never, there's a few people I just never heard from again. They had like a partial thing that just disappeared. So... yeah, it was highly, it was a lot more work than I I think, that I ever could have dreamed to put together this kind of book with so many people doing so many interesting things in the world. And, you know, everyone was just so busy. So.
Yeah. And you mentioned that you found people in different professions. And one of my favorites, actually, and maybe I'm like wildly out of the loop, but I hadn't heard of Camus Davis. Is that her name? The butcher, who's not a butcher or doesn't know if she's a butcher.
Right.
That was an awesome essay. I just loved it.
I love that essay too.
How did you find her? Did you know her?
Camus is one of my oldest friends. She and I have been friends since we were like 15. So that's how I found her. But she's become quite prominent in the food scene in Portland where we live.
Okay. Well, she was great. I totally loved that one. They were all fantastic. I really enjoyed reading Ayanna Mathis's story and hearing about the... So first of all, just, you know, she wrote this novel that was picked up as an Oprah book and Oprah's second iteration of the book club. You know, and the power of Oprah Winfrey to bring books to the public is just so extraordinary. But what a great essay. That one sort of talks about then, you know, what's next after so much unexpected success. And that was an interesting take on ambition too. She says at one point, why had it taken me 40 years to understand that I had the rights to my ambitions? And I liked the idea of that we have to give ourselves permission to be ambitious. So I don't know if you have any thoughts about that.
I love that essay. I just think that essay, it touches on so many issues, but I think one of the most, it's such a vulnerable essay about how ambition and success can be so complicated and kind of wounding experiences at the same time that they're so buoying. And that's the reason for that is really hard to understand. And that's sort of her work, is trying to unpack and understand why something that seems just so awesome could become also kind of paralyzing.
Yeah, I remember interviewing an author, a man, and we were talking about another man who we both know, who's a very phenomenally famous author. And the man I was interviewing said, you know, I'm actually rather glad that I don't have that level of success. And I thought at the time, sure, right. But he was like, think about how much pressure you would be under to always, always, always meet the last success, you know. And I felt like her essay sort of touched on that a little bit, too.
Yeah, I think it did. And, you know, also issues of race and class and gender and how those questions become even more complicated if you're, you know, if it's, I suppose, intersectional in that way. That's a wonderful, sure, essay is wonderful. It just went up on Guernica too, so readers can look at it there.
Okay, great. I wonder how you figured out the ordering of the pieces, and I assume that you also had an editor that you worked with at the, was it Liverite? Is that the publisher?
Yeah, right. It's a division of Norton. I had a wonderful editor. Her name is Katie Adams. She's super smart. I put together an order and then she sort of refined it. It was a tag team effort. And we definitely wanted to present, it was an interesting book to order because we wanted to present that we had this diversity of vantage points, both in terms of people's life experience, their class background, their ethnic background, and their professional background. And so we were sort of trying to put it together in some way that showcased the incredible diversity of the collection, but also had some thematic resonance. It's always imperfect to order a collection. You know, you always sort of have ones that there's like four you want as the first one, you know, and like six you want as the last one. You can't actually put four at the beginning, at least for the first essay. But I think, you know, one of the wonderful things about this project is there's not a dud essay in the bunch. So ordering it really became more of, you know, just sort of a artistic and aesthetic pursuit rather than hiding bad ones in the middle, which sometimes books.
I was curious if you were trying at any point to either group together or separate essays that had different takes on similar aspects of ambition. So, for example, several of the essays have to do with the balance of work and family. So were you mindful of like, oh, let's not put these two together, or yes, let's put these two together? And if so, why?
I remember at the beginning of the book, we definitely were trying to provide a breadth of experience, like, you know, women in all kinds of different life situations. It was intentional to put Yale with Elizabeth Corey. So Yale has a wonderful essay about being, she teaches at the Brown University Medical School. She's got a private practice, and she has three children. Elizabeth Corey has I love the essay No Happy Harmony, which actually I found through Yale. She and Elizabeth are friends. And No Happy Harmony is about how it's pretty, the myths we tell about how you can have it all contribute to deep unhappiness in women because it's not actually true. And those two are definitely grouped together. And then with Alison Barrett Carter's essay on being a stay-at-home mom and making that decision. I think we had some younger voices that were kind of woven together. And
yeah, actually, I have quotes from a couple of the people you just mentioned. I really loved some of this stuff. So this quote really caught my attention. Yael Shatav Schoenbrunn, is that how you say it?
I think it's Yale, but yeah.
Yale. She says of her life as a mother and a psychologist who works in research, I got to wear both hats today. Perhaps I'm imperfect in each role, but in this moment, I can appreciate being blessed to take part in both. I wouldn't give up either world because there is indeed satisfaction to be had in the balance. I love that. And then you had a very linkable moment in yours where you said, if you couldn't have it all the time, then you could have it all in moments. And I felt lucky. And I just, I really liked the sense that both of you had of just sort of like, you know what, we were expecting to be able to have it all. And in a way you have to temper that and figure out how you can have it all in moments, or, you know.
True. And you know, the more you have, the more you have to, you know, the more sort of blessed you are, the more you have all of these different categories of things that are fulfilling, the harder it is to balance them all. So it's messy.
Yeah. Now your essay, talks, about, it's funny. I found this not to be a terribly accusatory book, that sort of like splits the sexes and says, you know, but everybody has their own stories. And there was a story in yours that just pissed me off so extraordinarily. I just couldn't believe it. In two different moments, men hit reply all by accident. And if you had not been privy to the emails that came across your desk accidentally, you never would have seen how very much the game was rigged, as you put it. Do you want to just talk a little bit about that story?
Sure, which one?
I guess the latter one, the one where you almost got this, what you thought would be your dream job, but in the end it sounds like maybe you decided to step away. But
I did decide to step away, yeah. I mean, it was just very disappointing. And I had applied for a job where I live. So I guess to rewind a little bit, I had moved a lot for academic positions. I had two tenure track jobs. One, the college went out of business, and the second one was in the middle of nowhere. Well, that's not fair. It wasn't in the middle of nowhere. It was just in a place that I found it hard to live, and in a department that was warring, really had warring factions and was very unhealthy. So I decided to leave and teach. I teach at a low residency program, and I write and I do a number of things, but I don't have a tenure track job anymore. And so I have always been on the lookout for opportunities in Portland, which is where, near where I grew up and where we now live. And I had gotten an offer for a visiting professor that might lead into, you know, a full-time professor in the town where I grew up. And it was just it was cruel timing because I had applied all over the place, and it's, you know, hard to land these jobs. And I finally land one that's going to start like a couple of days after my due date. And it had taken me 6 years to get pregnant. And, you know, talk about a moment where you just feel you cannot possibly have it all. That is a moment where you just like.
And beyond taking 6 years to get pregnant, it took just like everything you had. I mean, just like, it was one of the stories that we hear about from our friends who couldn't get pregnant easily. You know, it's very expensive. It's very time consuming. It's very painful. Everything, right? In those 6 years.
It took multiple interventions, and it was a whole opera really to get pregnant. So, and it, you know, such a happy thing to be pregnant. I had really a lot of fun being pregnant and was extremely happy to get this offer. And I started negotiating, you know, I was going back and forth with the department trying to work out whether or not there was a way to do this job with a tiny baby.
Right.
And, I had some thoughts and we were in the discussion, and at the end of that discussion, I was accidentally CC'd on a email that was actually worse than the email that appears in the book. But, you know, I just edited out a few lines. It was just extremely demoralizing, because I thought we were having a conversation about working it out so that it would benefit everybody. You know, I had in the end asked to have a pay reduction and a reduction in duties, which seemed plausible from the conversations that I'd had with them previously. You know, as we were trying to move things around, it seemed like possible to do that rather than to have, you know, a double job with a 6-month-old or, you know, all the things we were sort of talking about. Mm-hmm. And the email that I was CC'd on sort of accused me of a number of malevolent, crappy personality traits for asking for this stuff. And, you know, and then I got a sort of almost crappier apology when I responded. And the whole thing was a mess. I mean, my first instinct, as I write in the essay, was to apologize for, I don't know, you know, I didn't really do anything, but, you know, to apologize sort of for existing, which is really irritatingly female.
Or for the audacity of asking for what would have best worked for you to become a member of this department and do it in a way that you could really balance everything.
Yeah. And there's a lot going on, I think, for the person who wrote the nasty email. I think who knows, but he doesn't have children. And I said that I had this book on women and ambition coming out right when the job would have been going on, and maybe that would have been nice for the university community. And I think he thought I was trying to play the girl card, and that was in the email. And I mean, it was just so, it was kind of a character assassination in the email. And that's what really I found so hurtful. And, I guess kind of amazing. You know, I didn't think I had done anything outside of what most people would do in a negotiation. But it was being spun in this whole other way. And I never would have known, except that he, you know, I don't know why, but he managed to put me on the reply that he was sending to his chair. So, I didn't end up taking the job. I just decided, I talked to a lot of people about it. People were like, you're going to have this little baby, and sort of the last thing you're going to want to do is go into this hostile situation.
Right.
So, yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the design of the book. I don't always bring up covers and design, but I really loved what you did, and that is on the cover and in the inside front and end page pages, you have quotes from lots of different people. I'm ambitious because I am still striving to fulfill my dream life, says a neuroscientist, age 32. I define ambition as setting challenging goals and achieving them, says an art director, wife, and mother of 46. It's probably, I don't know, there's probably 100 of these. And I really enjoyed them. I got into reading them all. So how did that come to be?
This was actually the brainchild of the book designer, who really was inspired by the project and who put a call out to women on the web and just asked to, you know, like, what is your relationship to ambition, or define ambition, and spread it all over the place. And women wrote in, and he got, I think, hundreds of responses, and then he picked and he sort of cherry picked the ones he liked, and he put them all over the book. And I think it's really cool. I think it speaks to the contagious nature of the conversation. Like, once you bring it up, people want to talk about it. Everybody wants to talk about it. They want to weigh in some direction, and there's just so much to say. And I think the book does, the design of the book does a nice job highlighting that. Just very the first design he thought of, so it's one of those lucky.
It also just really nicely sort of underpins what you've already been talking about around this subject, which is there's just so many ways to talk about it. You know, there's so many things that ambition can mean. So that was another way that it reinforces the whole book.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And it was one of the things that made it tricky. Like when I was saying that, you know, first you have to define ambition. I think that was one of the real challenges of the project, because, you know, is ambition, if I want to lose like 10 pounds of baby weight, is that an ambition? Not really. You know, it's a goal. It's something I would like. Or if I want to, you know, I don't know, like live in a nicer house in 10 years, is that an ambition? Well, probably not. So what is an ambition then? Why is it different from like an aspiration or a goal? And I think, you know, I found a way of sort of corralling that, but everybody had to find their own way to corral that. But I did want the book to stay on point. You know, I didn't want people to start writing about things that were not really ambition, that were other kinds of yearning. And so to me, ambition is the desire to do work that is good and meaningful in the world, to work at sort of the outer limits of your capacity, and to be recognized by people who are meaningful in that world for that work. So it's sort of like, you know, writing a poem and showing it to your mom and having your mom really love it is nice, but writing a poem and getting better and better at writing a poem and sending it out and having it land in the Paris Review and then, you know, in Best American Poetry and those things are reinforcing in such a way you've made a mark. You know, you've done something, and the people who are sort of the gatekeepers of that thing have reinforced your work. And that can happen in the sciences, that can happen in education, that can happen in like many, 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 you know, you could be a cook, you could be a butcher, but all those things require mastery. And mastery, kind of the nature of mastery, is that recognition is hand in hand with mastery, right? Like you can quietly become a master in your kitchen, but in order to make a mark in the world, you need recognition for that too. And that's one of the areas where I think women get flustered, because we're not really supposed to need, it sounds really kind of egotistical or selfish to say, well, I need recognition, or I need this schedule, or I need, like those things are tricky for women. In fact, in Lean In, one of the moments that I remember from that book is when she talks about women asking for a raise, how you ask for a raise. And she says something along the lines of, you know, if you go in and say, oh, look, I've done a really good job. I've, you know, made this much money for the company. I've recruited this many new customers. It's going to rub everyone the wrong way. So it's better if you're female to go in and say, you know, women are historically underrepresented in this industry, and I've done my homework, and this is how much, you know, men are making, and I feel that it's my responsibility on behalf of women to ask for this much money, you know, so that you're part of sort of a community of people. You're not like out there on your own. It's tricky business.
It is. Yeah. Now, speaking of the I thing, I wanted to ask you, in collecting essays for a book like this, you do end up with an abundance of I narratives, you know, people telling their personal stories that maybe have to do with their careers or their decision to have a family or not have a family. So I wondered if that presented any particular challenges as an editor.
Well, it was the goal of the book. So for me, when I sat down to think about this book, I realized, you know, there have been books, and really wonderful books, about women and striving and women in business, and I mean, Lean In most notably, but Anne Marie Slaughter had a piece in The Atlantic that led to more pieces. Anna Fells has an amazing book called Necessary Dreams. But one of the things that I didn't feel existed was a book of personal, nuanced stories about how ambition actually operated within a lived life, rather than like a set of tips or a bunch of statistics or proof that these things were a problem. I mean, these things are clearly hard. They're clearly a problem. Women are not represented at the tops of a lot of fields. You know, they drop out of certain academic fields to have families. Those statistics are readily available. What's less available are the stories of why and of how people have solved those issues and how messy the private sphere really is. And I think for me, going through a lot of struggle with my chosen career path and hurdles I faced starting a family and, you know, just any number of ways that ambition complicated my life, one of the things that I didn't really feel was available were the stories from people who came before. I knew these things were issues. My mom had issues. My mom was an attorney. I knew that it was a common struggle, but I didn't feel that there was really a map. So these essays were an attempt to make people feel less alone in the messiness that ambition creates in a woman's life. Because I think without that, it's easier to feel really isolated and to feel like you're just failing or to feel that, you know, you're just not that good at balancing. Mm-hmm. When actually these things are common and everyone is experiencing, like, you know, those feelings of being a fraud or being a failure at doing everything well, you know, feeling like you're never as good of a parent if you're working, but you're, you know, would be a bad parent if you stayed at home. You know, just these constant sort of demons that everyone's batting away are there for everyone. And I thought that would be profoundly useful, especially to young women.
And it is, and it's really well done. I'm wondering if in the case of editing these essays, you ever had to look at someone and say, you know, take your personal story and bring it in for a landing a little more, you know, I mean, and they all do. So that's why I'm wondering if you had to kind of, and I'm not asking you to say who, but.
some of the essays got wildly off topic because it's so hard to stay on topic because our ambition is tricky. But no, I think most people understood the book, you know, and understood the project. I mean, there was quite a bit of conversation leading to all of these essays. So by the time people wrote the essay, they sort of knew that it was a personal project for a larger good.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. You mentioned the Elizabeth Cory essay earlier, and I just loved this, and I was going to just mention it. She quotes Deborah Spar, who's the president of Barnard College, who said, "Feminism wasn't supposed to make us miserable. It was supposed to make us free." And then Elizabeth Cory goes on to say, "But feminism is not a lived life. It is a political movement, a set of ideas abstracted from experience and propounded as ethical imperatives. It should not surprise any thoughtful person when reality does not conform to the dreams of ambitious elites with bright ideas." I don't know. I found that so interesting, but also sort of somehow reassuring. I don't know. It just sort of felt like our lives don't necessarily look like what the outline was supposed to, you know?
The chilling moment in that essay that I remembered, I read that essay long before I commissioned it because it actually was one of the very few essays in the book that appeared somewhere first. Mm-hmm. But it just stayed with me, that essay. And the moment that stayed with me was when her former student, who was this brilliant student, she doesn't go on to have a career. She goes on to have a number of children, meets with Professor Cory and wonders if she can still have a career. And Professor Corey thinks to herself, well, no, you know, I'd love to tell her that she can, but it's really not realistic at this point. She sort of did miss. You can't have it all. You have to make a certain set of decisions, and every decision requires a sacrifice. And you can have both things, but they will not be perfect. And if you make one decision early on, it may be at the expense of other decisions. And that's just how it goes. You know, it's a hard truth, but yeah, I think there is something reassuring and comforting to having someone just say what we all sort of suspect or sort of know, right? That, like, yeah,
you've been lied to, you know,
or like, you know, these things are ideals, but the reality is there are a limited number of hours in every day and a limited number of days in every life. And, you know, there is only so much that a human being can actually pack into those hours and days. And so, and when you choose several full-time pursuits, it's just math.
Right. So your pursuits at this point in time are, you are a mom and you are a member of the faculty at Warren Wilson College, mm-hmm. in the low residency MFA program there, which is fantastic. And you write. So I wondered, what are you writing now? What are you writing these days?
Well, in the immediate right now, I'm sort of just shepherding this book into the world and trying to sort out the totally confusing world of how you deal with childcare, which I never knew. I never knew any of these things were so complicated, like breastfeeding and childcare. Good Lord. but I'm also working on a book about wanting to have a baby at the same time that I was working in teaching memoir in the women's prison to a bunch of women who were in a mothering program and couldn't see their children at the same moment that the prison was cutting the mothering program. And so they were facing this separation. So I lost my mother and I couldn't have a baby, and they were facing this separation, maternal separation from their children as well. And it's actually not so bleak, but it's a book about overcoming that and about sort of contemporary issues of maternal yearning. I think, you know, fertility and incarceration are strangely, like, both incredibly common modern realities. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I'm weaving those two things together.
That sounds really interesting. And then the other thing I was going to ask you is what you've read lately that you might recommend to listeners.
Well, I did. I just read a book called Fever Dream. Have you read it?
No.
It's by Samantha Schweblin. And it's remarkable. It's a novel. I think it's a Spanish novel. And so it's in translation. And it's incredibly scary and incredibly interesting in its craft. I highly recommend it. And I also read Elizabeth Strout's My Name is Lucy Barton and really loved that. Okay. It was the first book I read after I had a baby and was just totally gripped by that book as well. So those are my two favorites of late.
Yeah, I have heard of Fever Dream. I haven't read it. And my name is Lucy Barton. I just was so blown away by how much she packed into that novel, which, you know, if you just look at scene and setting, there are parts of it that are really quite static, but it's so, I just was really riveted while I was reading it, so.
Yeah, I think the thing that I thought was most fascinating about that book was that she sort of alludes to this terrible event in her childhood and never really tells you what it is for the entire book. Like, you think that's what the book will do. It'll ultimately reveal the big secret that was the big trauma in the family. And she does reveal some of them. But I just love the way that she manages to make some other truth out of that project instead of going where you expect her to go. It's really just so smart and interesting. The other storytelling I've loved lately is S-Town.
Yes.
Which does a similar thing, actually. You know, it's a podcast, and you think it's going one place, and then it broadens out and goes elsewhere in a way that I found really refreshing, given the political climate of, like, you know, presumption and stereotyping and like hate, really. And now there's this podcast that does this other thing, which goes from, you know, I think goes from kind of stereotyping into something deeply human.
Yeah, we have one or two of those left to listen to, but I was reading the reviews, and one of the reviews sort of said, I'm from that town, and I hate this podcast, because now everybody's just going to like think that we're a bunch of rednecks. And it was like, no, actually, the opposite is true. I feel like this podcast really humanizes this town and shows us just this little snapshot of a place that that I knew nothing about. And it does. The whole thing turns, very tragically, actually, but... into something very interesting.
Instead of bringing you closer and closer to an expected truth, it sort of brings you further and further into the messiness of a human being.
Yeah.
And I think that as creative people, and really as all people right now, just given what we're up against, I think that's a really profound and important project, is going towards a sort of universal human messiness as opposed to this surface stereotyping that we see everywhere right now.
Yeah. All right. Robin, I have one last question for you. And I wondered if you could offer a little advice for editing a collection of essays with multiple authors. How, having done this, what advice might you offer to listeners who are writers who might have this sort of project in mind?
I guess my biggest piece of advice would be pick something that is really and truly interesting. I was sort of grateful to myself that the topic never got boring, that I picked something that was so alive and so multifaceted that I could spend years listening to people grapple with it and never get bored or annoyed. Surely if I picked some other topic like women's relationship to kitchen remodels, I would have been like on board. But so I would say definitely pick something that you're endlessly curious about.
Okay, that's great advice. All right, the book again is Double Bind, Women on Ambition, edited by Robin Rahm and published by Liverite, which is part of Norton. Thank you very much for speaking with me today.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org and soon broadcasting on your radio at 99.3 FM. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and that was an interview with the author and editor, Robin Rahm. She's just edited the new collection that you heard us talk about, Double Bind, Women on Ambition, again published by LiveWrite Publishing. Her website is robinrahm.com. And this show is generously underwritten by Burlington City Arts, a public arts organization located at 135 Church Street that connects the community to the arts through free contemporary arts exhibitions, special music and cultural events, art classes and workshops, and a print and clay studio soon to be located at 407 Pine Street. On exhibition now at Burlington City Arts is Shane Lavalette's One Sun, One Shadow, Wiley Sophia Garcia's With My Voice, I Am Calling You Home, and The Past Present, work by Molly Bosley and Athena Petra Tassiopoulos. Free entrance Tuesday to Friday, 11 to 5, Saturday, 11 to 8, and Sunday, 11 to 5. More information always available at burlingtoncityarts.org. So this week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by our guest, Robin Rahm, who teaches at Warren Wilson's Low Residency MFA in Writing Program, as well as writes for herself. One thing that she loves to do as a writer is, at the end of the day, to write lists of very specific sensory things that she ran across that day. So perhaps a shirt or a snippet of dialogue, the details of a person's face. She'll write these things in a list in no particular order. She doesn't write feelings or facts, but things that have color and sound and smell. She might write dialogue, so the texture of the couch or the way the cat looked lying in the sun or something the mailman said. as he waited for her to sign a package. Having these lists leads to other things in interesting ways and gets you thinking like a writer. Robin says that these snippets will help you get rid of abstract worry and thought and help you to focus on scene building. She says the sensory and the concrete almost always lead you into more interesting material in a way that intellect almost never does. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. And then, of course, you can stream the show live each week at 99.3wbtv.org, Mondays at 3. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And if you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I say that every week. We haven't had any new ratings on iTunes lately. I really would love it if you would do that. Like it on Facebook, rate it on iTunes, let people know about Write the Book. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book on WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Thank you for listening, and have a great week.